All right, for those of you in the crowd, if you could take a seat and try not to, conversations, keep them real low if you're going to talk. Thank you much. We'll bring to order the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee and start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Considine?
Here.
Representative Dean?
Here.
Representative Flanagan?
Here.
Representative Hertas?
Here.
Representative Hillstrom?
Here.
Representative Howe?
Here.
Representative Lomer?
Here.
Representative Lucero? Representative Neuberger? Representative O'Neill? Representative Quam?
Here.
Representative Rosenthal?
Here.
Representative Schoen?
Here.
Representative Ward? Representative Zerwas?
Okay, I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes for March 17th.
So moved.
Representative Considine moves the minutes of March 17th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the order of business today for those in the crowd and spectators is we've got two bills. One that's fairly non-controversial to start out with, and I would like to move through that pretty quickly, Representative Howe, and then we'll get into the Appleton bill here after that. And the rules are just the same as they've always been for the crowd that hasn't been here before. No yelling or shouting, or try not to show any emotion after either side makes their speeches, clapping or acclamation or anything like that. Keep it quiet as possible, and then that way, without the interruptions, we can give both sides equal time, both the support and the opposition. What with this many people testifying, we'll probably have to do is divide it up and give people 2 minutes apiece. And we'll have to enforce the time judiciously, because if we don't on the support, then the opposition won't get equal time. So we'll keep track of the minutes here, and once we get started in that bill, and it's my plan to run through the bill and vote by noon. So, okay, the first bill, Representative Howe, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to move House File 2810 to pass and be referred to government operations.
All right, I guess the new motion is just referred to government ops. And, okay, the bill is before us. Do you have any amendments?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the A1 amendment to get it in the shape the author prefers.
Okay, Representative Howe moves the A1 amendment to get it in the form he would like. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion carried. Representative Howe, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for being here. The real crux of this bill is actually a more or less a Federal Conformity Act, if you want like to look at it like that, because the Federal Line of Duty Act has been amended over the years since 91, 92, and it's been amended to include different things, and it has been adjusted. In some ways, we have just not kept up with it. So this is a bill to kind of move us to federal conformity. What it does is it brings the Hometown Heroes Act at the federal level and brings it to the state level, so we're under the same guidelines. The other thing it does is it takes the rulemaking the decision from PRA on what's a line of duty and moves that decision basically over to the Commissioner of Public Safety. So the grieving family of someone that dies in the line of duty really has one-stop shop. They come to the Commissioner of Public Safety, puts their application in, and when the Commissioner of Public Safety determines that it's a line of duty death, PRA just has to determine what those benefits are and pays the benefits. And it also streamlines our procedure to go to the federal application. Currently, the federal application, requires a decision by the local authority to determine it's a line of duty. If you don't have that, it adds a lot of steps, and you have to appeal it. It's a big process. So what we'd like to do is, in this bill, streamline the process to come into conformity with the federal law. And, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move to the testifiers then.
Okay, first testifier, Chris, your name and title, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Parsons. I'm president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. And as I begin, and I'll keep my comments brief out of respect for your time, I am here to speak on behalf of the state's firefighters, EMTs, paramedics, hazmat techs, and technical rescue personnel. As firefighters, these days we wear many hats and have many missions, so I just want to make sure that you understand that my comments are reflecting that. Numerous studies over the past couple decades have brought to light the issue of firefighters and other first responders, high instance of fatality on the job due to heart attacks. These studies have been published in respected journals such as the Journal of American Medicine and the New England Journal of Medicine. Despite being much healthier than the general population, firefighters have not seen a decrease in the heart attack rates when compared to the general population, and we're also more likely to suffer heart attacks at younger ages. There are many things that that add to these risk factors: sleep deprivation, the cumulative physical and traumatic stress that firefighters undergo throughout the day and throughout a call, have shown to increase inflammation in the body, increasing the risk of heart attacks. We also inhale toxic fumes, smoke, which lead to pulmonary conditions, which can lead to heart failure. And these are outlined in the studies, which thankfully in 2003 the federal government, Congress, Senator Pat Leahy passed a bipartisan bill. This bill passed unanimous consent in both the House and the Senate. And the bill was co-sponsored by a bipartisan variety of lawmakers, including Senator Dayton, Representative Sabo, Representative Klein, Representative Oberstar, Representative Ramstead, Peterson, and McCollum. And since its passage, many states have adopted the language of the 2003 Federal Hometown Heroes Act, either in actual statute or in policy. Minnesota has adopted that policy, thankfully, despite our current narrow definition of killed in the line of duty. What we're looking to do is just codify current practice. And we have a couple testifiers here that can speak to some of the actual cases that we've had in recent years. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Okay, thank you. Next testifier, name and title, and give us a brief statement, if you would.
Good morning. I'm Crawford Weisling. I'm a retired fire chief, but most of all, in the state of Minnesota, I'm the state advocate for the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. I have been involved in the line of duty deaths as kind of the liaison between the fire service in Minnesota and the Department of Justice through the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, which manages and oversees the federal benefits for public safety officers. You all call it the PSOB, and that covers the whole range of our public safety officers, and it oversees those benefits and pays the survivor benefit package right now, which is the one-time payment at the federal level now is about $340,000 for a line of duty death. We operate under the Hometown Heroes Act signed by President Bush in 2003. That has become the federal guidelines for submitting claims of when a firefighter loses his life in the line of duty. That is the bill that basically extended and pushed the parameters, added the 24-hour timeline to a duty or an incident, taking into account that the stress factors and the heart attacks were becoming too commonplace in the fire service. And that's the reason why that bill was extended to that level. So in Minnesota, as Mr. Parsons had presented to you, the fire service in general was able to, we're working on that because unfortunately we've had some some recent line of duty deaths that are current. So we operate in submitting the benefits or getting the program package put together and submitting it to Department of Justice for the federal benefits, usually through the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation as a as an intermediary or a travel agent that, that submits these claims and monitors these claims through the Department of Justice to make sure that the families are taken care of at the on the federal benefit. The history on this was that we came to bear was that we realized, and with the acknowledgement of the Commissioner of Public Safety, that when Fire Chief Matthew France from Rice Lake Township died, what was determined to be a line of duty death in December 9th of 2013, there was two areas of travel to go through that got us into a bind, and we started off right away with getting the federal benefit package put together for Department of Justice. Then we came to tackle the state benefits, and we went to the Commissioner Doman and talked to her about the whole process, where she has the authority of determining the line of duty death with all the backup supports and documents from the other agencies. What we got into was that she openly admitted to us that she did not have real good guidance or knowledge of what to do to determine or confirm a line of duty death application in the state of Minnesota. We sat with her and we provided her and the Attorney General representing the Attorney General's office the federal guidelines on line of duty death applications and what it was to take to determine a line of duty death, and they were surprised. They admitted they hadn't seen that. They didn't know what it was. I think that some of that ongoing knowledge has now come up to her level. She's become aware of it. As most of you, some of you know, the state then just recently now has granted the benefits to Matthew France's wife and family, and that's a wife and two young children that are waiting or needing these benefits to continue to survive. And that's the process, is to basically inform you today or ask you is to provide information that we need to get this filing procedure and the language together so when one of these unfortunate incidents happen, we don't have to go down two separate paths. It can be done in one course of action, and the state and the federal level of measuring, monitoring, and granting the benefits becomes the same in the same program.
Okay, Representative Neuberger, quick question.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Howe, for bringing this bill forward. I think this is a step in the right direction. I did have two questions for you briefly. First one pertains to line point 2.2 on the bill. In as much as I'll start at the first page, you have here that you have a 24 hours after engaging or participating in a clause one, and the presumption is not overcome by competent medical evidence to the contrary. That's the 24 hour issue. My question to you is, if let's say you have a firefighter or a paramedic who gets off of work and then 18 hours later has a sudden cardiac arrest and dies, and we have to have this competent medical evidence, who pays for the autopsy? Because what I'm worried about is that if you have a death that occurs that's not a vascular rupture, but you have a different type of death that occurs, and they're dead, the person has died, and now we have to have this autopsy to prove that it was a vascular rupture. If the family has to pay for this autopsy, only to find out that it wasn't a vascular rupture, let's say it was some other means of death, now you've got a family that not only had a tragedy that someone who had died shortly after they'd finished their shift, but they didn't fit the criteria of vascular rupture, and now they're stuck with an autopsy bill.
which, as we all know, can be, in some cases, quite expensive. So my first question would be is who pays for the autopsy?
Anybody can answer that?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, that line is actually, if the that presumption, what it is actually for is to not allow the payment of the deal. So I don't know, you'd have to have somebody performing an autopsy for a reason, and if they rule, the medical examiner rules that it, they've got medical evidence to the contrary that this shouldn't be a presumptive, right, then they don't get it. Right. So you'd have to have a reason for the medical examiner to do it. Right. So I don't.
Second question.
Oh, I'm satisfied with that, Mr. Chair. I just had one more question here as well. As we move through this, again, my only concern is I don't want to have a grieving family get stuck with an autopsy bill to find out that they don't qualify for this. I think that would be a disservice. But I'm satisfied with that. The other question that I have here is that there are the majority of your emergency medical personnel within the state, frontline paramedics, do not work for public agencies. They are not PERA members. They work for private ambulance providers. North Memorial is one. They have an enormous group of people that work for them. Gold Cross, they're all over the state. They're in Fargo. They're in Duluth. They're in St. Cloud. They're a private provider. We also have Alina. They are all over. We have hundreds of paramedics and EMTs who serve our communities who are not PERA members. So would they also be covered in this, or is this for public PERA members only?
Anybody?
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, this would cover all first responders, including those paramedics that you mentioned. The para piece is specifically for first responders that are in the para system.
That's really good news. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Members, keep in mind this is really not a controversial bill, and we got the votes to pass it. So the next testifier, if we could give a brief statement.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Smith. I am a fire captain in St. Paul, and I've had the opportunity to go through the process twice in the last 3-4 years with two of our members. One was a heart transplant. This last one, last August, we had one of our members collapse at the station in cardiac arrest, and our own members had to try to resuscitate him. And being that when the whole thing went down, he was brought to Regents Hospital. Luckily enough, our medical director, Dr. R.J. Frasconi, and his two other assistants were present at the hospital. They brought him up to the cath lab, tried to put the stent in to open up his artery that was clogged, and it was unsuccessful. He collapsed about 5 o'clock. They pronounced him dead about 6:40. Left behind two daughters, age 1 and 8. In St. Paul, we're fortunate enough to have a working relationship with our medical staff at Regents Hospital. But after the grieving process happened, which majority of people are still grieving this one, the family, we help out as St. Paul firefighters, help these families secure these benefits through PARA, the state PSOB, and the federal PSOB. And when PARA determined theirs, they ruled it a regular disability. It was not line of duty because his death was not caused by performance of an inherently dangerous duty specific to his position. So you guys had mentioned, taking care of these families, and that's what this bill will do. Not every agency has a working relationship with the medical staff like we do at Regions. So this basically turned into a bill that we had to get a doctor to testify, write a letter, and make it a definitive case that the stress and everything from the job was in relation to what he performed that day. And our whole thing is that if we can't take care of our firefighters that do, whether it's police, fire, in uniform, in the station, collapses, the determination was he had 100% occlusion of the left anterior descending artery, which is basically called the widowmaker, was reopened, never restored. But again, the resuscitation effort that was given, not everybody's entitled to that, but the family shouldn't have to go through this process of trying to determine if it was a definitive or not. It was the heart related, and I think that's what this bill will help do.
Next testifier.
Mr. Chair and members, my name for the record is Dennis Flaherty, and I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, which represents about 8,500 rank and file officers throughout the state. And I'm going to keep my remarks very brief. We're just very pleased that we're on the way to making Minnesota's law consistent with the federal law. I think you got an excellent background on the Federal Public Safety Officer Benefits Program. This will make it easier for the survivors to understand, and they can consistently seek both the federal and state benefit. And I think it's really important that you're recognizing the very stressful nature of the jobs performed by public safety officers, as well as the strenuous training that goes along with it, in order for them to continue to be proficient at their job. So, and that's what this proposal does, and we stand in support of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Director. And we'd like to call up Ms. Finn from the League of Minnesota Cities. Is she here? Your name and title and begin, ma'am.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. And I just want to let you know that we are trying to get this bill reviewed by some of our workers' comp attorneys. We hope that it's as straightforward as the author explained, and I've been in touch with Representative Howe and the proponents of the bill. But we cannot be neutral yet at this time, given that we think there may be some other implications when it comes to workers' compensation and even perhaps the continued health insurance benefit that we want to have a chance to look at. And we've been assured that we can continue those conversations between now and the next committee.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. Any questions from the committee? Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Howe, I'm with you, and sorry to the League of Minnesota Cities, but, you know, we're out there doing our job. It's just sometimes it's just time to pay due. And the one thing I brought up to Representative Howe was a question in definitions, because the blue shirts, the folks in the blue shirts, the Capitol Security officers that take care of us on this big complex, it doesn't look like we've got it very clear in 299A that they're covered under this. For instance, in 299A sub 4, parent 9, where it points out that troop or anybody under the state patrol employment talks about the commercial vehicle enforcement, and some of those back in the day used to be non-sworn employees too. And so I think we need to make sure that we need to cover the Capitol Security officers that are taking care of us, and the public and the school kids that come here every day as well too. And I'm not talking, the troopers that are wearing tan that are the sworn officers are already covered, but it's the folks that are the civilian employees that are in uniforms that you see in light blue shirts. I've talked to Mr. Diebel about it, not to do anything today, Representative Howe, but if you would be okay, this just came to my attention too. As we move this forward, it would be nice to make sure that we're taking care of them as well as it progresses down the line. But I just wanted to bring that up.
Mr. Chair, and I'm going to look at Section 626.84, Subdivision 1 and Paragraph C and F to see if they're not included in that. Yep. And if they're not, we'll make that change and make sure they are. That's not our intent to exclude them.
Thank you, Representative.
And with that, Mr. Chair,
any questions? If not, you want to renew your motion?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to remove my motion to refer this bill to government operations as amended.
As amended. Okay, you have all heard the motion. No questions. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, carried. Thank you very much for your presentation. Okay, Representative Miller.
I can move this bill.
Representative Miller, I'll move your bill, House File 3223, to be referred to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, is there a fiscal note on this bill yet?
A what?
A fiscal note.
Mr. Chair?
Just a fiscal,
Mr. Chair, a fiscal note has been requested on this bill. The bill came up on the schedule rather recently, and so it was submitted last Friday. The agency has not had a chance to respond yet.
Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, this is a fiscal committee, and typically we don't pass bills out of a committee unless we've seen the fiscal note and the cost. Is it your intention to deal with a fiscal note after the fact, or how is it that you intend, as the chair of the fiscal portion of this budget, to deal with the fact that we don't have a fiscal note on this bill?
Well, historically, I think both parties have sent bills out of here with fiscal notes and then pulled them back or sent them to Ways and Means. So my intention is to send it on and address the fiscal note at some time. We're certainly not going to ignore it.
Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Chair, I would like to have your commitment that, again, I have an amendment to this bill. But in the event that this bill goes forward, I would like the commitment of the committee that we will explore and discuss the fiscal issue and not just leave it to the Ways and Means Committee.
Sounds like a good idea to me. All right. Representative Miller, you go ahead with your, and you know the general plan. We'll give the original presenter a little more time, but when it gets to the support and opposition, we'll split it up 2 minutes. For both sides, so go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to begin by thanking everyone who has come here in support and perhaps not in support of this. I appreciate the time that they've taken out. Some people have traveled quite a bit. I believe a government that works is a government that has the people involved, so I thank everyone that's come today for this. I come today with a common sense solution to a growing problem in our state. The state of Minnesota faces a crisis. Our prison system is severely overcrowded. This is not a new problem. Our prison population has exceeded the capacity of our state prisons for several years. Because of this overcrowding, the Department of Corrections is currently leasing 500 beds at county jails because there is no room left in our state prisons to house offenders. This is not an acceptable long-term solution, but it has also become problematic even in the short term. Just last week, the Star Tribune published a story about the, quote, aimless limbo that prisoners find themselves in when they are stuck in county jails. The article is in your packets. One inmate, one inmate who had previously been at Shakopee's Women's Correctional Facility, Andrea Gunderson, was taking mental health wellness classes, working towards her GED, and participating in a parenting program that allowed her to spend 4 hours with her 12-year-old daughter once a week. But now, because of extreme overcrowding, Andrea was shipped to a county jail where she sleeps up to 20 hours straight and has absolutely no access to mental health or other rehabilitation programs. She can only interact with her daughter for 20 minutes at a time over a video screen. She wants to improve her life, but doesn't have that opportunity in a county jail. As a state, we've made an important commitment to providing offenders access to programs that are proven to reduce recidivism, such as treatment for mental health and addiction, rehabilitation programming, and education. But because we have not adequately addressed our overcrowding problem, we are failing to provide even the most basic of services and programs to hundreds of offenders. I find that unacceptable. This is truly about what is best for the offenders that are in our state's care. It is our responsibility to ensure they are in the best position to succeed when they return to society, and locking them up in a county jail and throwing away the key is not the answer. To make matters even worse, the DOC has admitted that they have already experienced difficulties finding beds at county jails to house offenders, and that it is a, quote, realistic possibility that we could run out of room in jails too. It is not an overstatement to say that we are currently in a crisis. It is beholden upon us to do something about it now, this session. That's why I proposed House File 3223, a bill that directs the commissioner to enter into a lease agreement to operate the vacant 1,600-bed prison facility in Appleton and run it just like any other state facility with good-paying union jobs. I recognize that there has been some concern about the company that owns this facility, which is precisely why we have drafted the bill in this way. The company would have no involvement in the daily operations, staffing, or inmate care at the facility. It would be entirely run and operated by the DOC, just like any other prison facility in the state. The Appleton Prison would also bring hundreds of jobs to our state region. The Appleton Prison would also bring hundreds of jobs to a region of our state that still continues to struggle economically. I'll let some of the testifiers who are here with me speak more on that, but I do want to call your attention to the fact that more than 50 cities, counties, school districts, and faith organizations have publicly supported this plan, and more than 1,000 Minnesotans from across the state have signed on saying they support the Appleton option. You see that over there on that board. These people and organizations who live, work, and raise families in western Minnesota cannot understand why we in St. Paul continue to ignore their needs, especially when they have such a no-brainer solution to a major state problem sitting in their backyard. Any way you slice it, we need more prison beds in the state of Minnesota. Even if sentencing guideline reforms do go into effect this year, they are only projected to open up 560 beds over the next 10 years. The DOC's own projections show that our prison system will be more than 1,300 offenders over capacity in just 6 years. The math simply doesn't add up. A lease of the Appleton Prison provides the state with the flexibility it needs to address our prison overcrowding problem immediately while allowing conversations about how best to implement sentencing reform to continue. Thank you for hearing this bill today. I especially want to recognize that almost 50 people from western Minnesota got up early this morning and made the trip to St. Paul to show how important this proposal is to our communities. Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, I ask for your support of this bill. Mr. Chair, I now wish to turn this over to my testifiers.
The CCA, they are masking lives. They're only interested in, they're saying that they're here to boost the economic system.
Sir, could you please sit down? You'll have your chance to testify. Please sit down or I have to have you removed. Come on. Please sit down. Please sit down. The people that want to speak for you aren't going to get a chance if you keep talking.
Hey, from both sides of the table, sir, this isn't helpful to your cause. This isn't the place.
Please
sit
down.
You'll have a chance.
Please.
From both sides of the table, we got to let the process play out.
All right. Any questions for Mr. Miller or Representative Miller? If not, the next testifier, if you could make a short presentation, it'd be great.
Excuse me. Good morning. I'm Roman Fiddler, clerk treasurer for the City of Appleton. Thank you for inviting us here to testify today and for Representative Millard for authorizing this bill. The Appleton option is a unique opportunity for the state of Minnesota to provide individual families in western Minnesota with good-paying jobs, and the facility has sat empty for 6 years now. When the prison was operational, 80 of the 350 employees actually lived in Appleton and bought and supported the community. We are very interested in the employees being AFSCME members and union members. The region has struggled to rebound economically for the last 5 years with the farm prices and everything. Some people who have worked in the Appleton prison in the past and surrounding communities have left the area because of no jobs. We recently hosted a forum in Appleton, provided opportunity for neighbors to come and listen to the concerns. There was around 400 people that showed up on a stormy, windy winter night. I can tell you firsthand that people in the region are confused and frustrated when the option that is there is not being looked at closer. One other frustration I have is that there's legislators that have verbally said they will not open the prison, but they have never actually toured it. So they don't have actual truth of how it does look. Those who live and work in western Minnesota see it as a solution for the state of Minnesota and also a benefit to western Minnesota. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, sir. If you name and title and begin.
Mr. Chair, Gary Hendricks, Swift County Commissioner. Been a commissioner since 1997, so I have a little bit of history with the facility, and I'll give you a little bit of history with it. In 1990, the city was the entity that initially built this facility. It was as a result of the outmigration of the 1980s farm crisis that it was built. It was built to keep as many people in the region as possible by giving them good jobs. And at that time, it was AFSCME position jobs that were offered. This was a union shop at that time. By 2000, this facility was sold to CCA at the time, and they expanded it to 1,600 inmates. Originally, it was a 500-bed facility. It was enlarged to 1,600. And at that point, we had, you know, when we were full, we had over 350 people working there at $15.2 million of payroll, which was very good for our area, not just Appleton, but for the region as well. When it closed in February of 2010, we lost that advantage. We had an advantage with 350 workers. We lost that. As time went on, we could see that on our business community. We lost people within our region. So this option, as we are seeing today, fulfills what we're looking for. We're looking for those jobs. We're looking for union jobs. We're also looking for the facility that can help the overcrowding of Minnesota inmates. Being a county commissioner, we have a jail. A jail does not offer the programming, the counseling that a prison offers. That is good for both sides. It's good for reducing recidivism, and that is what we're looking for. As a county commissioner, I'm looking for that also. So we're looking for this to be open, union people from the state of Minnesota, offering your own programs. We think it's a great idea at the time. It will help revitalize our community, and we support Representative Miller in moving forward with this bill. And little side note, last year, Swift County had one of the highest unemployment rates in Minnesota at 6.2. The highest, the peak was 8.2. So this is a region that needs it, and that's why you have the people coming out today. This is a facility that needs to be open, and we're looking forward to it. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair. The lie they want us to believe is that opening prisons is about creating jobs. The truth is that CCA
will you please sit down, ma'am?
Private prison comes to the United States, and private prisons are being used as new forms of slavery.
Ma'am, could you please sit down?
Cannot turn a profit.
Sergeant Rhymes, could you ask him to...
1,600 more beds is not the answer for mass incarceration. Five of seven of the men in my family have been incarcerated. Five of seven of the men in my family have been incarcerated.
What is it about black people that you guys don't like?
You can't do this to us. No. No. No on house file.
Ma'am, please sit down.
Hi, Mr. Chair. I'm Jennifer Frost. I work at Swift County Rural Development Authority, and I'm just going to provide some fast facts for our region, not Swift County, not Appleton, but the five-county region. It's the Upper Minnesota Valley Regional Division, which includes Swift, Chippewa, Big Stone, Rock Apparel, and Yellow Medicine County. And you heard Gary talk a little bit about our population loss. From the 1960s to 2010, our region has lost 34.57% of our population. Swift County has lost 34.5%. Two counties are higher, two are lower. That's what we've seen, and that was the impetus for building the original facility, was to deal with this population loss and give people good jobs and a reason to stay. When we look more currently, you also heard Gary talk about our unemployment rates. Our unemployment rate as of December 2015, this is from Deed, Minnesota, the state, was at 3.6%. Our region was at 4.6%, and Swift County was at 5.7%, a full 2 point higher than the state. Our labor force, and this is folks that have jobs or are able to work and looking for jobs, for Minnesota, it's a little over 3 million, 3,033,000. In our region, it's 25,000, and Swift County has 5,304 in our labor force. And so when we talk about the impact of 350 jobs, and this is what the Appleton facility employed less than 10 years ago, it's not that big of an impact to the state. It's 0.01%. When we look at the region, it's 1%. And when we look at Swift County, it's 7%. It's huge. It's a big impact. And that's why we're here. You know, one of the things we looked at, too, was the top employers, both by number of people employed and wages paid. In our region, healthcare and social services is the top at 3,551 employees. Manufacturing, second, 2,054 employees. And education is third at 1,842. These are also the highest wages. So when we look at wages and we talk about good-paying union jobs, we say, okay, well, in Minnesota, the median hourly wage is $18.65. In our region, the medium hourly wage is $15.34. It's a full $3 less. And so when we look at what the Minnesota Department of Corrections entry-level wages are, they're between $16.75 and $19.87. That's over our median wage right now in our region, our five-county region. And so, you know, we're here to say, you know, this isn't just about jobs, but we have an asset. And you, the state has a problem, and we think they match up pretty well together.
Okay. Representative Miller, we're going to have to start the two-minute thing now. Pardon? We're going to have to start the two-minute option now.
Okay.
And my LA will keep time. We'll get to Representative Schoen's question here in a second. We'll start the two-minute option now, and when it gets to 2 minutes, if I notify or somebody does, then you know, we're not just going to shut you right off, but take about 5 seconds just to say.
Hobbiton residents, last few words. Mayor, can I convince you that this is about a job employment? It's a
ma'am?
Ma'am?
Could you sit down, please?
This is. Ma'am? No, trying to go to the right people, enrollment is working, the black people, the people
complete. Ma'am, please sit down. Thank you. Okay. Ma'am, go ahead. Oh, Representative Schoen, you had a question for.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment. Representative Miller, I just wanted to maybe take an ounce of umbrage with a statement you made in your opening remarks about ignoring the needs of Appleton and the people of St. Paul or what we're doing here, and that's just not true. And you and I have talked about this, and I have a great understanding of you're trying to represent your community, and I've talked to you, and I know the governor's office have talked over the years, have talked to folks out in Appleton about what opportunities we could do with deed grants and other things to help the community, and it's near and dear to my heart, and you know that as well, too. But no one here is ignoring the needs of Appleton. We want Appleton to do just as well as we'd like the folks up on the Iron Range to do. They have a great amount of needs, and you're talking about 8% unemployment at a max, but we've got communities up there and communities all over the state that are talking about 22-plus or 30%-plus unemployment in certain communities, and that's true, too. So I just want you to remember, that doesn't need applause. I just what I want to say is that there is not an ounce of Minnesota that the people here in this room, and I mean every single one, that in their heart doesn't feel for when they're having a downturn or having an issue. So please don't say that stuff. It's not helpful to your cause. And I know we're going to have a lot of other questions and comments. So I just that was kind of stung me a little bit.
Thank you. Okay, 2 minutes, ma'am. Go ahead.
You saw my sheet when you said 2 minutes.
Name and title. We'll just stop you at 2 minutes.
Thank you for your time this morning. I am Vicki Oakes with the Ortonville Economic Development Authority, and I also work with a countywide economic development group. And in Ortonville, we are not looking for handouts. We're working hard to build on our assets, and we do consider Appleton Prison one of our assets also. At the point of their phase down, when the jobs totaled 284, the jobs lost in Big Stone County totaled 34. This may not seem like a significant number to those that live in and around the metro. However, in Big Stone County, a new business opportunity bringing 34 jobs coupled with an entry-level pay that Jen had mentioned earlier, it's above our region's median hourly wage, would be amazing. We struggle with the tax disparity between us and the Dakotas, and this is an opportunity to create jobs on our side of the border. And the need for inmate housing has been established, and it's projected to increase. The Appleton facility is already constructed, state-of-the-art building, and you hold the keys. Other than the economic development, which that is what I represent, we are not asking the state to incarcerate more people. We are asking that you house them in an environment that will provide the services that they need. And I did want to mention on your point, as far as what you do for rural Minnesota, we are fortunate in Big Stone County to have been included in the state's first round of broadband funding, which is awarded by Federated Telephone. And although the fiber is just starting to be installed, we have been working the past year to educate our businesses and residents on the uses and benefits of this tool. We have also adjusted our economic development focus to include regional recruitment on Ben Winchester's, and that fits perfectly in with the housing and that. And in closing, I would just like to say thank you to those that have supported the rural broadband investments, and thank you to those that are working hard to utilize our assets, the Appleton Prison, to meet the needs of our state. Okay, both are very important. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
36 seconds.
Then, next testifier. Next testifier. Ma'am, could you please sit down? Cutting into the time of all your supporters, sir.
It actually slows down the growth of rural development.
Okay. Who's the next one?
Vicky O.
Oh, sir, go ahead with your
Mr.
name
Chair,
and title and begin.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and committee members, thank you for this time. My name is Paul Ramo. I am president of the Appleton Area Chamber of Commerce. I'm here representing the small businesses in Appleton. Actually, I'm here representing literally thousands of small businesses within a 60-mile radius of the city of Appleton that would be affected by the prison opening, bringing to it 300-plus high-paying union jobs in the immediate Appleton area. Small businesses in the towns of Madison, Montevideo, Ortonville, Benson, Morris, Milan, Kirkhoven, Hancock, Holloway, Bellingham, small businesses in Dawson, Marietta, Chicago, Graceville, Glenwood, Wilmer, Clara City, Granite Falls, Clinton, Danvers, Watson, Starbuck, and many more communities. Thousands of businesses, some of them mom and pop, most of them family owned, would benefit from this prison operating again. My friends Barry and Joan Foost, a husband and wife, who own an eating establishment in Appleton called Shooter's Bar and Grill. Mr. Chair, they are here today. They're sitting behind me. They struggle to keep the doors open. They are some of the hardest working people I know. Pass this bill for them. Tim owns the local grocery store in town. It's a small grocery store. Let's pass the bill for Tim. Or the barber in nearby Madison, the butcher shop in Dawson, the Riverside apartment owners that have apartments sitting empty in Appleton, do it for them. The car dealer in Benson, the small gas station in Bellingham, the Moore Cafe in neighboring Milan is a family business. You see, opening the prison in Appleton and bringing high-paying union jobs will drive more customers to local businesses and will affect thousands and thousands of Minnesotans in western Minnesota. I invite you and any representative and senator, and I invite Governor Dayton to come visit us in Appleton and tour the prison facility and see our wonderful community. And I'll even buy lunch.
Okay.
This is the state of art. This is a state-of-the-art prison, and it's sitting empty.
2 minutes.
Minnesota has a severe problem with overcrowding in its jails,
sir,
and a problem with inmates with mental illness that need to be treated and are not getting the treatment they need in the county jail.
State, sir, your 2 minutes are up. Please stop.
Thank you.
Okay, you need to stop because we get the opposition. We need to stop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Will you please sit down, sir? Will you please sit down?
Under form of correction control. We do not need more prison beds. We do not want any more.
Yes!
We do not want more any
please.
Complex continuing legacy of slavery. This is a new way of slavery. We need to end this. We do not let government.
Close your arms. Can you have it down?
All right.
All right. Next testifier, state your name and title and begin.
My name is Ronald Ronning, former mayor of Appleton for the past 8 years, 22 years retired from the military, and 14-year employee at Perry Correctional Facility.
Still good.
Go ahead. I'm here to talk about Appleton and its effects on Appleton because I can report that as a mayor, has a devastating effect on the community. We're a home of honored veterans, all streets named after war veterans that have passed away. Go ahead. All right, you folks can't quiet it down. We're going to respect you when you come up here, and we appreciate if you do the same. The opposition will get the same opportunity. Go ahead, sir.
You don't respect us because you did. You might have to think about my incarceration or why you're investing in schools and mental health and environmental justice. Representative Corden. You guys have a real weird understanding of respect. It goes both ways. Respect is investing in our lives, not
okay.
We
can close the meeting and have everybody come out and just testify us come back in.
You've
got to let us continue here.
If you reopen this question, but that's not Trump. The only economic gain comes to people who look like you.
Hey, no one wants this to be a closed process. We just want people to be able to come to the testifier stand.
Okay.
And both sides can have that opportunity. Representative Cornish has made that clear. And whatever you want to read or say, you'll be able to do it on the record so that you can actually speak into the microphone. And I think that's the best way to do it.
Okay, sir, could you go ahead and begin again?
How much time to wait for to testify?
Could you go ahead and read?
And they said there's 20 spots, and that's all you're
going to
take.
Just as mayor, I can testify to the effects of the devastation that the closing of the prison has had on our community in several areas. $1 million in wastewater, water, $15 million in wages, housing market suffering, foreclosures causing the tax base to shrink, which lays the burden on our makeup of elderly within our community. And the younger community that we did have at one time has dissipated. We are a proud community, very caring community. We care about Prairie Correctional Facility. It's part of us. We support it through our ministerial programs. We support it through our educational programs with outside resources. And we support it through the educational program, through vocational programs. And those types of things that we have. And I'll keep very short here. We have a resource in Appleton. All we're asking is that you allow, that you look at this resource to utilize, to handle the deal, the things that you need to deal right. with. And I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you. Next testifier. Name and title.
Jackie Sigdahl. I work for the Upper Minnesota Valley Regional Development Commission right now. Thank you for having us today. I started working at the prison in 1992, about a year before we ever received our first inmates. I had recently moved back to the area after being away for about 6 years. I worked as the warden's assistant, and then before I moved into the HR department for about the last 6 years that I was there. It was a job I loved, and because of the position I had the privilege of working with a lot of the staff, and these were people that they took great pride in their job. They loved what they did. They cared about each other. They cared about the performance that they did every day. They cared about their communities, and they cared about each other. Even though we employed, you know, close to 350 people, it felt like a family. You know, it was a small group. We felt like it was. We knew each other. We knew our situations. So I think when the prison closed, it just made it that much harder emotionally, because like we were like family. And it not only affected us as staff, but it affected the community. Because in Appleton particularly, because of the businesses, the schools, the housing situation, and it also affected the entire region. So you can imagine when we have that many people that are working there, we had a lot of people driving into the community. So those people weren't stopping at the local gas stations anymore and filling up on gas, and weren't picking up snacks or getting their groceries or picking up their dry cleaning. And so, you know, it definitely affected the community, but it affected the entire region as well. I mean, I'm just one person, but there's a lot of people like me that have their stories to tell about being in Appleton.
Let's finish up 2 minutes. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And Chair, the legislation and the CC.
Okay, ma'am, if you want to give your name and address. Right. Or, excuse me, name and title, and then begin.
My name is Tori Gamarud, and I'm a nurse currently at Appleton
Please,
Area
ma'am.
Health.
Please sit down.
1,600 beds is a penalty for being poor.
Ma'am, will you sit down, please? Sergeant Lawrence, could you talk to
this meeting is not legit without a fiscal nut. And I know that for a fact because I fight for the Welfare Rights Committee. And there's five committee meetings. And this one is not important enough. You are misdirecting your energy and your funds and your heart.
Ma'am, could I ask you to sit down so I don't have to have you removed?
Caucasians, build daycares, build other things that promote a quality of life. This is a gift.
Ma'am, could you sit down, please?
How did I just, you should be fired.
Trying to give you every opportunity.
This is out of control. You have no fiscal note. So you are disrupting due process, and that's it. You need to adjourn this meeting, shut it down. There's no need for a vote.
Ma'am, we only got two people left, and then the opposition can testify.
In front of people. And you see how we feel about it. These people right here are not going to be employed.
Ma'am, you please sit down.
They're going to be in jail. You have no right to disregard the 70,000 children and then find a place for them. You do not have the right. I have a son. He's been shot by a child. Now you tell me where you're going to have the kids in Appleton.
Ma'am, could you please sit down?
I do not have time to sit down. I'm trying to save my kids.
We got
to
move on.
So we can live. Take that $250 million and invest it in people's quality of life. It is not fair. It is not fair that we sit here and contend with a party and you make and create our lives into a hell.
Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to go into recess and clear the room. Thank you. Okay, we'll bring the meeting, the House Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee back to order. And what we'll do is we'll start out with the opposition. We're going to have Commissioner Roy of the Department of Corrections first, and then Nikema Levy Pounds second. And then after they testify, we will have 10 additional people from the opposition testify, and then we'll go into Representative Hillstrom's amendment and then vote. So, Mr. Chair. Representative Considine?
In all the rigmarole, I still wanted to bring up that one thing. I thought it would be a good idea why the commissioner was here.
Oh, go ahead.
Anybody interested in going to the CIP graduation on Monday, you would have to be there by about 8:30. Any takers? Okay.
Get a hold of the representative.
Yeah, I realize it's a day off. And I, you know, and anyway. And Commissioner Roy, if I could chat with you just for a second later, that would be great. Thanks.
Okay, Commissioner Roy, even though I said your name three times, go ahead and give your name and title and begin.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Tom Roy, Commissioner of Corrections. I was introduced as in opposition to Appleton, but I see myself here. I see myself here today as being able to provide you with some background very briefly, and I think right at the onset it's important to say that prison expansion, new building, is not on the Department of Corrections plate whatsoever, nor is it on the governor's plate. And what I will talk about this morning are strategies that we think can deal with the overcrowding problem and satisfy both sides of the aisle in terms of fiscal conservatism and good social policy. I've been at this for 41 years, and I have discovered that there's only three ways you can control prison population. You control the front door, who comes into the prison, and how long they stay for. In Minnesota, the guidance on that door opening is given by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. It's given by statute authority to me and our agency for parole violators. It is part of the negotiation process between prosecutors and finally with the judge signing off. Those folks, and myself included, control the front door of the prison, who comes in and how long they stay for. The second control for prison population is the exit door. How can we release people more successfully? What can we do while they're with us to make them more successful when they re-enter? What kind of programs should we have in the community that assist people coming back from prison? And that back door, the exit door, is in statute in a couple areas. Very specifically for us, we have authorization for work release, and we have authorization for the Challenge Incarceration Program. Both of those are early release programs that we have the potential of expanding. We have the ability to control those parole cases that might be coming back to us. And we feel very positive that we can do that without great statutory change or authority from this body. The third way, and the reason we're sitting here today, is that policymakers, the executive branch, can propose new prison beds and new building. And of the three options I just stated, this is the most expensive option that's available. We currently have in our budget request a proposal to modify an existing building at Lionel Lakes that will add 60 beds, and we also have a proposal to expand the Challenge Incarceration Program by 75 beds. So we think between changing policy around revocations of probation and parole, with the added 135 beds, with investing in programs that we have demonstrated have a significant return on investment, we think that we can meet the challenge of the prison population that currently exists. It is, in terms of the Appleton facility and privatization, and I know the question is going to be asked, and I'll comment on that very quickly. The role of government is significant in the criminal justice arena. Some states, it is so significant that they can take the lives of criminals. In Minnesota, we take freedom. It is a responsibility that I think falls clearly on the role of government. The notion that we incarcerate people for profit, for corporate profit, I think is the antithesis of America. People have gone to war over freedom. People have given their lives to working in the criminal justice system to make it a good system. And if we don't perform well in the government realm, we are discharged from our duties. And I think the citizens of this country and the citizens of the state of Minnesota expect at the highest level of government that we are engaged in criminal justice. We would not for a moment think about privatizing police. We would not for a moment think of privatizing our courts. Why would we consider privatizing corrections, the final stay? I am going to conclude my comments with an opening for questions, if there are any, Mr. Chair.
Questions, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Roy. Earlier in testimony from Representative Miller, he talked about the sentencing guidelines recommendations that wouldn't take care of the 500 and 40 beds, I'm not sure is the exact number today, that wouldn't take care of it in a period of 6 years. And when I look at all of the different types of things that we've been discussing at the Prison Population Task Force around issues related to sentencing reform, if you reduce fifth-degree drug sentences to a gross misdemeanor, in a period of 4 years, you could reduce the amount of beds 416. And if you add on top of that something that I think we should consider here at the state in changing the two-thirds of time served to 60% time served, in a matter of 4 years, you could reduce that by 718 beds. And so what that does is that gets us to a number of 1,134 without the sentencing guidelines recommendation. So it's clear that there are some things that we can do rather quickly that could curb the amount of beds within the state of Minnesota, the prison beds. But, you talked at your conclusion about some things that I think are really, really important. And today we've heard a long economic argument for the area around Swift County and what that means to the people there. And I know that Representative Sherman mentioned it earlier. There are lots of areas of our state that are currently struggling. And the question is, are we looking at all of those areas of the state that are struggling and willing to invest $140 million, a commitment of $140 million over 6 to 10 years to actually fund that? And I don't think we are. And this is really just more of a statement, because I have a feeling there won't be times for statements at the end, but this is a question that I think we all need to answer for ourselves, and that is, do we think it's okay to build an economy that's on the back of inmates? Because that's what we're doing. So I just hope that as we get ready to move this and hear some of the other testimony, that folks listen in the same way that we listen to the folks from Swift County, that what's in their heart is real, what they're trying to do is real, and that for some of us, we just see that there's maybe a different way of addressing that issue than reopening the Appleton prison. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Roy.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Nikema Levy-Pounds. Thank you, Commissioner. Let me know if I pronounced your name right, ma'am, and then you go ahead and begin. Oh, you wanted a question first? Commissioner, could you come back for a second? Representative Hertaus had a question for you. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Roy, in your presentation, you characterized the three different options that we had, and I guess I just wanted to make clear the suggestion of what a lot of this controversy is about. Although there's a perception that we are locking up an inordinate amount of people in this state, the fact of the matter is that Minnesota ranks third lowest, or 47th in the nation, in terms of our incarceration rate. In Minnesota, we don't lock up people like they do in other states. On the other hand, we rank eighth highest with regard to adults under direct correctional supervision. And that, is of concern, because today, one in 24 adults approximately in Minnesota are under direct correctional supervision. In 1858, when we became a state, and in our enabling legislation, we established 70 felony violations in statute. Today, there's more than 400. I'm not suggesting that today is not different than it was 150 years ago, and there certainly has been a need to impose laws that are in the interest of public safety. But we have had a tendency historically in the legislature of over-criminalizing behavior. And to that end, there's been some suggestions on what to do. And I think there's been a bipartisan effort to make reforms with regard to felons and the getting these folks back into society and making them productive human beings and reducing the rate of recidivism. What I'm taking issue with in particular was your characterization of the privatization of the prison population. Initially, at the beginning, or even at the end of last session, I don't remember when it started, but there was a proposal, at least from your department, to request $141 million for expansion of 500 beds. And I think as a legislature, we have a fiduciary responsibility to understand that that's $280,000 a bed. And there are so many resources that are being restricted or limited, and we all have to make choices. And I'd rather see that amount of money go into diversion programs, because we've over-criminalized fifth-degree drug convictions, and I'd like to see people who are addicted, who are low-level offenders, who are not the ones who are making an enterprise out of drugs, to get treatment, and that we get them back into society. So the Appleton proposal wasn't the privatization of prisons and industrializing prison populations in a for-profit proposition. The proposition was to rent the space and save the cost, the capital investment of that $141 million. So I think that's something that we need to remember. It's not too much different than the House and the Senate rents this building from the Department of Administration. It's not too different from state agencies all across the state leasing facilities rather than owning them. And in many cases, that's a smarter decision than building it. Nobody's been proposing that this is a privatization of the criminal justice system or the prisons and that it was going to be something different. Everybody, I think, on both sides of the aisle was advocating that it would be run by the state. And so I just want to make that distinction and make sure that everybody understands that that's what the issue is about with regard to considering Appleton. Thank you.
Okay. Nikima Levy Palmas.
Good afternoon. My name is Nikima Levy Pounds, and I'm the president of the Minneapolis NAACP and a law professor at the University of St. Thomas. The primary focus of my scholarly research is on the impacts of mass incarceration in the United States and in the state of Minnesota. I know that the last point that was just made focused on the fact that to do business in Appleton is not to privatize our prison industry. However, who we do business with is just as important as the business that we decide to do. The CCA has a terrible reputation nationally for its treatment of prisoners, including many who have died under the care of the CCA. They have been known for falsifying records, and they've been known for cutting deals with different jurisdictions in which they require a 90% capacity in order for the prisons to function. Doing business with CCA is like doing business with the devil, because their practices, and as our state that prides itself on being progressive to some degree, we need to be mindful of the message that we're sending by doing business with the company that has such a terrible record. Beyond that, criminal justice reform is a nonpartisan issue, but it should also be a no-brainer. We should not continue to invest in the abyss of our criminal justice system when what it is doing is not producing people who are more productive when they return back into society, but it's producing people whose mental health issues have often been exacerbated, who come out of the criminal justice system and have major difficulties finding employment and housing, and who are prime candidates to return back into our criminal justice system. In fact, we have one of the highest rates of recidivism in the country. And yes, we pride ourselves on being a state that has a relatively low incarceration rate, but according to the Department of Justice, our prison population more than doubled over the last decade, when the trends in other states are going exactly in the opposite direction. As it was stated earlier, we have 1 in 26 Minnesotans, according to the Pew Center on the States, who are under some form of correctional supervision or control, roughly 9,500 inmates, and over 100,000 who are on probation or under some form of supervised release. We need to take seriously the proposals that have been put forward about overhauling our probation system. That makes the most fiscal sense, and it is also a way of preserving human capital. But it is one of the recommendations that has been largely ignored over the last several years. One of my law students, Elizabeth Schoonfish, prepared a document that is about to be handed out that talks briefly about our probation system in Minnesota.
We can hand them out for you.
Some of the challenges within that system and some of the ways to fix the system. So one way that she's researched is focus on more consistency in probation revocations in response to probation violations. Another way to fix the probation system is early release from probation. There are some counties in Minnesota that have early probation discharge procedures, including Anoka and Dakota County, but Hennepin County does not currently allow probationers to be released early. So we need to take seriously the impacts of the probation system and ensure that there are proper checks and balances in place and that we don't continue sending people through the revolving door of the criminal justice system as a means of doing business as usual. It's time out for business as usual in our state. We also need to stop locking up fifth-degree drug offenders. We also need to implement the reforms of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. As you all know, we have some of the toughest drug laws in the state, in the country, and it has not stopped the curb of the flow of drugs in the state of Minnesota. So we need to do something different. So I see all of the adversity and the opposition as an opportunity to set the standard for the rest of the country, to not go in a direction that will continue to dehumanize people who are poor, people who face mental health issues, people who have substance abuse problems, and people of color. Those are the folks who currently comprise our criminal justice system, and frankly, it's time for a change. We also cannot focus almost exclusively on the economic interests of the people of Appleton, although we have empathy for them. But the reality is that it is a small white rural town with an over 8% unemployment rate. But when you compare that to the fact that people of color, particularly African Americans and Native Americans, have double-digit unemployment, then frankly, there's no comparison. I have not heard much discussion about the high unemployment rates in the inner city communities that are actually fueling our incarceration rate. And we cannot continue to ignore those challenges. I heard a couple of legislators mention that. However, as a body, we need to be thinking about taking a holistic approach to addressing the concerns that people have. And part of those concerns are the ability to feed their families and to have a roof over their heads so that they will stay out of the system. So that being said, I hope that this body takes seriously the concerns that have been raised by people in the community and asking you to not do business with the CCA and to not open the prison facility in Appleton, Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Okay. What we'll do now is we'll move into 10 of the opposition and just 10, and when we get done, then we will move into Representative Hillstrom's amendment. And the first one I've listed here is it Ian Cantonin, campus organizer? We can come back to that one if it comes in.
My name is Eric Adelstead. I'm the Western Minnesota organizer for the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group. I was able to make it down from Morris today. MPIRG is a student-directed, nonpartisan nonprofit which represents students across the state of Minnesota. I'm also a lifelong resident of Western Minnesota. I grew up on a farm a couple of townships east of Swift County. I've lived and worked in Montevideo and Morris and Moorhead. I'm also a homeowner in the city of New London. And I've come from the prairie today to urge you to vote no on this bill. I grew up in the aftermath of the farm crisis in the 80s, and I've experienced firsthand the issues facing rural Minnesotans. I've watched stores on Main Street and many neighboring towns close down, and many of my neighbors sell their farms. As you're all well aware, rural communities were decimated during the crisis, many of which have never recovered. Communities across the state and country like Appleton have been forced to make difficult decisions, and some have gotten so desperate for prosperity that they are willing to sell their soul to the devil. We're all aware of the mass incarceration problem in the United States today. We incarcerate more people than any country on earth. We also know that much of the growth in prison population has been catalyzed by imprisoning nonviolent drug offenders, and we further know that despite equal rates of drug use between white communities and communities of color, people of color are incarcerated at immensely higher rates than whites. We know that punitive approaches to drug crimes are not only unpopular with voters, but build recidivism and have been wildly ineffective. Despite all of this, we continue to ramp up ineffective, unethical policies that destroy communities of color. Put bluntly, this bill puts the interests of the rural poor against the interests of the urban poor. The people of Appleton in North Minneapolis, many of whom are in the room today, want nothing more than stable, well-paying jobs and strong communities. And quite frankly, it's disgusting that they're being used as political chess pieces in a corporation's quest for profit. CCA wouldn't have flown in Dick Gephardt's lobbyists from Washington, D.C. if anything else were the case. And I don't know if you know this, but they're a pretty pricey bunch to hire. In fact, the projected profit that CCA would drain from the state of Minnesota is greater than the current cost of housing prisoners in county jails across the state. Tying human incarceration to a region's economic stability and to a company's bottom line is absolutely abhorrent and has no place ethically or financially in the state of Minnesota. By allowing CCA into our state, we allow them a profit, which gives them an incentive to keep their prisons full. So, as they have done in states across the nation, they will lobby against drug policy and sentencing reforms. This means that instead of reducing the prison population...
Sir, could you start to close?
I've got a page left. I'll wrap it up. Instead of reducing the prison population and saving taxpayers' money, we will literally be paying them to lobby our state to keep their pockets full and their lobbyists on the Hill. We've been pitched this private prison as a means of economic development rather than what it is, a corporate handout. If anything else were the case, why has not a single economic development project for Appleton and Swift County been brought before the legislature? Why not invest in projects that serve community needs? You're all very well aware of the enormous difficulties facing rural health care providers, from senior health care to mental health. I know I'd rather be spending my tax dollars giving money to my elderly neighbors rather than CCA executives. Or how about the fact that annually we send $18 billion out of the state to import electricity? Western Minnesota has huge untapped potential for clean energy. What about investments in rural water quality?
Sir,
in county-specific tax...
Can you wrap it up?
Yes.
We're giving you way more time than we gave the support.
We have... Appleton and Swift County and West Central Minnesota have a lot of alternatives to explore that will attract young people and good-paying jobs to the region. Throughout this process, I'm often reminded of what Jesse Jackson said when he marched with farmers in Glenwood in 1985 against farm foreclosures. He urged unity between rural and urban poor to fight foreclosures then, and I don't think it's a stretch to say that his words are just as relevant today as they were then. I would urge my neighbors on the prairie to use this opportunity to reach out to some of the folks from North Minneapolis today and trade stories. We can't allow corporate agendas to divide us. We must realize our common interests and work to build strong, vibrant, and prosperous communities no matter where we call home. Representatives, I urge you to not allow corporate agendas to divide the people of Minnesota any longer, and I urge you to vote no.
Okay. The next, if you want to come up together, Reverend Grant Stevenson and Reverend Nazim, well, they're both from Isaiah. I don't want to mispronounce the name. So the two reverends from Isaiah group. Thank you. And if you could try to keep it to around 2 minutes, a little over.
I won't be long. I'm Pastor Brian Herron, and Grant wanted me to speak on instead of him. I won't be long because Nakima and this other young man has said what needs to be said. It is very obvious that this isn't about the people from Appleton. We face the same dilemma in North Minneapolis with unemployment. One of the things that I don't understand is why are we having discussions about opening prisons rather than discussions about closing prisons and doing things that are going to help people move forward in their lives rather than incarcerating them? Why are we having discussions about building an economy off of black and brown bodies?
White
Because the reality is that when you put together the toxic cocktail of the violence of poverty, and you put together the cocktail of no employment and no employment, and when you put together all that in the mix of poor education, no investments in a community, and when you open up a prison, you're going to fill it. There's no way you're going to open something and not find a way to fill it. And so it's going to be filled with black and brown bodies. We already know that. And so we're against this whole opening of the prison, whether it's CCA or the state of Minnesota. We don't need to open any more prisons. What we need to do is begin to reason together about how we get out of this morass and begin to move people's lives in a forward trajectory. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. All right, we'll state your name and title and go ahead, sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Reverend Nazim Fakir. I'm pastor of St. Peter's AME Church in South Minneapolis, as well as a representative of Isaiah. And thank you for this opportunity to speak. I really echo the sentiments of those that have come before me, but I just want to remind us of a couple of things. This company that we're considering doing business with is a multi-billion dollar company that has made all of its profits on the back of the misery of other people. And that's something that I don't think the state of Minnesota wants to get into. While this company has become a multi-billion dollar corporation, has also become exceedingly controversial with a record of prisoner abuse, poor pay, and we talk about trying to raise good jobs for the people of Appleton. Well, people of Appleton, this company does not have that kind of record. They have poor pay and benefits to employees, scandals, escapes, riots, and lawsuits marking its history. The Huffington Post states and shares that the CCA prison has been the subject of multiple lawsuits alleging rampant violence, understaffing, gang activity, and contract fraud. CCA acknowledged last year that falsified staffing reports were given to the state showing thousands of hours were staffed by CCA workers when the positions were actually vacant. And the Idaho State Police is investigating the operation for the in the facility. As a matter of fact, Idaho took control of that prison. And so I stand here as a man of God, a person of faith, who believes in freedom and justice for everyone, who believes in redemption. And I echo the sentiments of my colleague, Pastor Heron. We ought to be having a different kind of conversation. We ought to be having a kind of conversation where we determine how we can increase the value of people's lives as opposed to devaluing them. We ought to be having the kind of conversation when we're trying to encourage folks to live a better life as opposed to locking them away and throwing away the key. We talk about 8% unemployment in Appleton. Well, in North Minneapolis, the unemployment rate is almost 50%. State of Minnesota, unemployment 3.6%. But for African Americans in the state of Minnesota, it's over 17%. And so what are we doing for those people? Where's the $140 million for the programs for education and for health care benefits and for treatment so that these folks don't get caught up in the system? So I stand here today, I sit here today, and I ask you to vote no. Because this is just another way to enrich the lives of a few off of the pain and misery of many.
Thank you, sir. Next, we have Tommy Franklin from Justice for All and Take Action. If you could keep it around 2 minutes, that'd be great.
I'll keep it around 2 minutes. Around. How you doing, Mr. Chair? Some friends of mine at NAACP and Justice for All left you some voicemails last night. Restore the vote for 47,000 Minnesotans. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Restore the vote for 47,000 Minnesotans on probation or parole. Restore the vote. Check your voicemail. Is anyone in this room in opposition of reopening Appleton Prison? Please raise your hand. Thank you. Now, I don't have all the answers. I'm not armed with alternatives, but I do possess some truth. I spent time incarcerated in five different Minnesota prisons, four of them state prisons, one of them Appleton Prairie Correctional Facility, owned by the CCA. And when you're being bounced around prisons, which I believe is to slip you up, going in independently, not gang affiliated, first time offender, you have to do three things. Number one, you have to protect yourself. Number two, you have to have a sense of humor. to get on. And based on the first half of testimonials, I remember that. I need to have a sense of humor. The third thing, though, is you need to settle in and you need to find some comfort. And when you're being bounced around, that's not easy. And when you're in a place like a CCA-owned prison, it's the hardest thing to do, to find comfort, because it's deplorable conditions. It's also miserable for the correctional officers. I witnessed that in my 2 years spending there. So when we're being shipped into Appleton Prison on a bus, when these farms, and some of these farms are closing down and being sold, when they see that bus driving into Appleton, that should not give the community hope when they see that bus drive by. I talked to a lot of guards, and they were coming in from outside of Appleton. They're working first, second, third shifts. They didn't seem to have too much interest in going to the local butchery or hanging out at the local bar after they got off their shift. They wanted to go home. I refused to work inside a private prison for 12 cents an hour, 12.5 cents an hour. So I sold poetry for money. I believe working in a private prison is wage exploitation at its most egregious in these modern times. Now, Representative Dean and Nakima gave you plenty of examples and statistics on why this is wrong. And yes, the people that testified earlier felt what was in their heart. That does not mean what they felt was right. We do not need to open any private prisons anywhere in the world.
Getting up around 3 minutes.
Well, I'm just going to say this. Appleton should not be known for having a private prison. No one should know a community for a private prison. You talk about greater Minnesota. Instead, what are we doing to make Minnesota greater?
All right.
Okay. Adam from the student at University of St. Thomas. Adam? There you go. Welcome, Adam, if you could give your name and go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Adam Weinzettel. It's okay, most people don't pronounce it right. I'm a resident of Chaska, Minnesota. I'm also a student at the University of St. Thomas, and I'm a leader in a group that we call the Mercy Project. And so basically what we've been doing as Catholics, as students at St. Thomas, as human beings, we need to be focused on mercy and seeing people compassionately and seeing people for who they really are as human beings, as our brothers and sisters. So we're focusing on behalf of the Jubilee Year of Mercy on doing various corporal works of mercy, like feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, giving drink to the thirsty. And one that we're doing that was our first event was visiting the imprisoned, where we got students together to write letters to prison inmates and gave them information about Perry Correctional Facility and CCA. It was overwhelming how few students knew about this prison and how few students knew that private prisons were in existence at all, and how baffled they were that people could make a profit off of human beings being incarcerated. In just 2 hours, we gathered 270 letters and signatures, and this represents a small portion of students at St. Thomas who are against this motion to reopen the prison in Appleton. Minnesota has consistently been one of the states most focused on improving behaviors of inmates and reducing recidivism. And I, along with the other students at St. Thomas, believe that to open this prison is completely counterproductive to the war against crime, to decrease crime rates. Our crime rates are lower than they have been in the past, but we're putting more people in prison. And that doesn't make any sense. We need to address that problem, not address the problem of 1,600 extra beds that are going to be filled, especially by minority populations. We believe that as citizens, we need to stand up, and no one deserves to capitalize on the imprisonment of another human being. And we need to believe in the goodness of people and their ability to amend their lives when given the right opportunities. We need to provide them with those opportunities. Pope Francis says that mercy is the force that reawakens us to new life and instills in us the courage to look to the future with hope. And if we forget to look at our brothers and sisters who are being incarcerated with mercy, and instead we look at them as commodities to be bought, we are not treating them with mercy. We are not looking brightly at our future. and I hope that in the future, myself and the other students at St. Thomas can say that we live in a state that does not support CCA. Thank you.
Thank you. Now we have Tim Henderson from Ask Me Council 5 Field Rep. What is your name and title, and begin, sir.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Joe Brogy, and I'm a corrections officer. I work at Stillwater Prison, where I've been for almost 9 years now. I never would have thought when I began this job that I would be there very long, and here I am. And I want to speak on behalf of my fellow corrections officers that we vehemently oppose the reopening of the prison in Appleton. For a variety of reasons, many of which other speakers have already touched on, but from my perspective as a corrections officer, we simply do not have the logistical support to operate another facility that's 4 hours away. The majority of our facilities are in the greater metro area, and we are already stretched incredibly thin for staffing. When I began in corrections in 2007, I was outnumbered, my fellow officers and I were outnumbered by about 50 to 1 in our living units. Now that number is about 75 to 1. We haven't had any increases in staffing. If we are going to stretch an already thin pool even thinner, that raises a whole host of issues. On top of that, we have a SORT team, which is basically our version of a SWAT team. If there are any major incidents, we have to mobilize and get out there to Appleton. Another reason is to keep prisoners happy, because you have to. That's all we have, is an illusion of control. We do not have any real control over a correctional facility that couldn't be snatched from our grasp if the inmates had any cohesive identity. We divide and conquer, and that's basically the only way we can make it happen. If we lose that, they could take over a facility very, very easily. And if you're stretching us already thin as it is, we just had an incident at Stillwater where we almost lost control of our dining hall because we were trying to implement new seating procedures to prevent extortion. We couldn't do that in Appleton, and if they took over, that would not bode well for us. And lastly, we have to make sure that those who are in our care, and that's what they are, they're in our care, they're not in prison to be punished. They're in prison as a punishment. We're not there to make their lives harder. We're there to protect the public and protect states and protect the inmates. And most of our offenders come from the greater metro area. And their families and their ability to visit their families is vitally important. And if you move them out to a facility that far away, that's going to be taken away from them. And that's simply something that we cannot have happen to our inmate population and maintain any modicum of safety.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Right on to. We have questions from Representative Flanagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to speak to what the testifier just mentioned regarding the majority of the folks who are incarcerated are coming from the Twin Cities metro area. Is that correct?
Correct.
So as we're looking at, in particular, recidivism rates, we know that those go down 2 times for folks who have connections with their families. I'm concerned about the 16,000 children who have parents who are incarcerated in Minnesota. And, you know, I believe our first responsibility is to children and families in this state. And it is incredibly troubling to me, both for the recidivism rates of those who are incarcerated, but also for the development of their children, that we would profit off the backs of those who are incarcerated while at the same time putting up additional barriers between children and their families. So I just appreciated that you brought that up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Schulman.
Sorry, just one quick question, Mr. Chair. Are you, some of the, about the distance, are you making any reference or discussion or thought process about reintegration? So I know families have a lot to do with that. I mean, and about trying to reduce recidivism is, and you didn't necessarily directly talk about the reintegration of prisoners back into society and how that's helpful. Is this an issue that you see there from some of the programming standpoint?
Mr. Chair and Representative Schoen, absolutely, absolutely. Recidivism is always an issue in any correctional system, from county and local jails to state prisons, even to federal prisons. And I have seen, in my 9 years, I have seen scores of inmates, "Hey, Officer Brogy, I'm back." Some of them laugh it off. Some of them are angry. And I really can't speak to every individual because everybody has a different story. But it's important that you stay connected to your communities. And I've had guys that say, before they leave, I'll walk up to them and say, "Good luck out there. I hope I never see you back here again because this is not the place to be." And they laugh and say, "Thanks, man, I'm never coming back here." And a year later, they walk in through the door. I say, "What happened?" "It depends. A lot of it is I just got back in the same crowd I was hanging with before, and this is where I end up." A lot of it, a lot of them complain that they don't have any due process rights when they are called up for a probation violation. I wish I could speak more on that, but a lot of these guys, if their PO decides that they're going to go back to prison, they're going to go back to prison, and they really don't have a full right of defense as they would in a criminal trial. So that's also an issue. I wish I could speak more to that. But absolutely, community integration is vital. We are taking steps, and to be fair, they are half measures at best at Stillwater, but we are constantly trying to improve their ability to visit. Now we have new kiosks where they can do video visits, and that's proven to be very popular. We also have to balance those against security concerns because, unfortunately, a lot of our contraband is introduced through visits. So we're constantly playing, you know, weighing the pros and the cons. But visiting is very, very, very important. And all you have to do is work inside a facility and see how the guys react when visiting privileges are suspended to see how important it is to them.
Okay. Thank you. Our next testifier would be Roxanne O'Brien from Minneapolis. Go ahead, ma'am, if you'd state your name and begin.
My name is Roxanne O'Brien, and I'm from North Minneapolis. So how long do I actually have, since there was many different times given to people?
Well, we just said 2 minutes, but we've been letting them run over up to 3 minutes, so go ahead.
So, God, where do I start? I didn't plan my speech, because I wanted to listen to everybody first. And from what I've heard a lot of propaganda, a lot of lies, and it just sounds like one big conspiracy, okay? I brought my kids up here today because they both of my daughters and my son, who's not here today, have experienced a loved one incarcerated. And I don't know if you guys have experienced that, but you seem to be having a lot of opinions on something that I don't think you've experienced. So I don't even understand how you can make that decision. But let me tell you, I met their father. I was working a job. He was very helpful to me, came out. He supported me in everything that I did, basically. He was a really decent man. And unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to ask him a lot of questions about his past. I didn't find out until later on, until he lost his job. He was a welder. He actually learned how to do welding in prison, which is not something that you guys do anymore for prisoners. We're not learning anything that makes us better when we get out. We're definitely not getting any jobs when we get out. So all this conversation about jobs, I don't understand it, because it doesn't seem to be relevant when it comes to our people and our communities. But my point to make is he made $15 an hour. Okay, he was working a good job, making good money, and all of a sudden, some corporate company moved that company to Mexico to pay people 50 cents an hour to do the same job. Okay? So it's all connected. It's all connected with the ICE raids. It's all connected. This is just slavery by another name.
That's right.
And you guys know it. And we're not stupid. We see right through you. We know this is about money. We know this is about your friends and how you want to help them make more money. We know this is about your ancestors who have forever profited off the backs of poor and people of color and indigenous people. We know that, and we're very angry, and we're not going to sit here and let you just pass bills like this. I want to tell you something now about his past, because I think you guys get it confused sometimes who the real criminals are. He was born in Arkansas, Little Rock, very racist town. His mother had 24 kids just from herself. They were sharecroppers, so it was very normal for a family to be that large because it helped the slave master, right? And even though they were sharecroppers, they still didn't make anything, so it was still slavery. During that time that he lived on that land, he witnessed his dog get shot by a white man. His mother, while pregnant with his brothers, was shot by a white man. He witnessed all type of white terrorism. None of those people ever went to jail for that. And his father, who worked on the farm with his mother for a long time, they both were taken out of their homes 2 o'clock in the morning by the Ku Klux Klan, forced to work and pick cotton. Have you ever experienced that? Can you imagine what type of trauma that would put you and your family through for the rest of your life? His father had to take all his kids and sneak them out in the middle of the night to Chicago to get them away, because the owners of that land wanted to take those kids and make them slaves too. Okay? When he came up to Chicago, you know what happened. There was a strategic plan in Chicago. You guys moved all the jobs. It was white flight. It was strategic. It was set up this way. There was nothing for them. And the father died. The father died of a stroke. And then the insurance company wouldn't even pay the insurance money out. So these are crimes that have been happening to poor people who are being locked up for their trauma from things that you guys have perpetuated against them. Uh-huh. I just think, you think we're stupid. You think that we don't know that this is all about money in your pockets. This is about dollars. You cannot convince us that there's a reason for our bodies to be in your institutions. Like, you're going to do better for us. You've never done good for us, ever. You've never been good for us. You've never made good decisions for us. You don't even make good decisions for yourselves.
Wow. That's
up. Ma'am, you're about 4. And
anyway, I just wanted to, where's my phone?
You got something to hand out? Or
okay. Oh. I wanted to bring up a voice from the past real quick, just to remind you guys. I don't know if you've ever heard of Malik Shabazz or Malcolm X, but I just want to bring him in the room with you guys again. Brothers and sisters, I'm here to tell you that I charge the white man. I charge the white man with being the greatest murderer on earth. I charge the white man with being the greatest kidnapper on earth. There is no place in this world that the white man can go and say he created peace and harmony.
Amen.
Everywhere he's gone, he's created havoc. Everywhere he's gone, he's created destruction. So I charge him. I charge him with being the greatest kidnapper on this earth. I charge him with being the greatest murderer on this earth. I charge him with being the greatest robber and enslaver on this earth. So if you're going to build a prison, you guys should make a bed for yourselves.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. That runs us to the end of our witness list and into Representative Hillstrom's amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Chair, in your packet is the DE-1 amendment. The DE-1 bans private prisons in the state of Minnesota. It deletes everything regarding the current bill. Members, the state of Minnesota rented beds from Appleton previously. When I was first elected to the Minnesota House of Representatives, Governor Pawlenty started contracting for prison beds with Appleton and housed many of Minnesota offenders in the Appleton prison. Back then, it was bipartisan in opposition to housing inmates in private prisons. Representative Steve Smith was the chair at the time, and he and I worked together to attempt to stop the rental of these bed space. At the time, Appleton Prison would not accept inmates that were older than 60. They wouldn't accept anyone who had serious medical conditions. They cherry-picked who they took, and they didn't offer the services that the state required. It was Governor Pawlenty in 2010 who stopped renting beds. So this isn't a Democratic or Republican issue. This is about what's doing right for the state of Minnesota. So members, I'm asking for a roll call vote, and I ask you to adopt the DE1 amendment. Reopening the Appleton prison and renting beds from CCA, they are a private company with a horrible track record, and not only a horrible track record across the country, but a horrible track record right here in the state of Minnesota. It was a Republican governor who stopped renting beds, and I don't think that it's the right thing to do for the state of Minnesota. So I ask for a roll call vote on the DE1 amendment, and I would ask that you help me ban private prisons in Minnesota.
Representative Hillstrom, we were at the end of the witness list, but we had two.
I was on that
list. If you'd let me finish. We have two more people that wanted to testify, so. Who are they? Could you have them? We made an agreement, I guess, for two more. So if two more people would come up, 2 minutes each or three, we've been running over. And then we'll come back to the amendment and for a roll call vote, Representative Hillstrom. Sorry about that. Your name wasn't on the list.
It's okay.
Whichever one would like to begin, your name, and go ahead.
Good afternoon. I am Betty Ellison Harpole. Now you know my name, sir. I'm a 37-year retired teacher. I had the first all-day kindergarten in the city of Minneapolis at Bethune School across from the housing project. When the president of the school board, Judy Farmer, said that the children in the housing project did not know how to hold a book, Dr. Richard Green, who was the superintendent of schools, asked me to pilot the program, and I did. There were children coming from the housing project. At the end of the year, when they would always test them to see if they were ready for the first grade, because they claimed that the children would not be ready from the inner city for the first grade. I asked if a cadre from central office would test them so they wouldn't say we had done something different. The children tested higher than the suburb of Bryn Mawr. All children are born learning ready. What they learn and how they learn, we control. We have not taught a child until the child learns. Our lack of education, quality education in our inner city schools ends up making many children drop out or not feel good about their abilities, which sometimes equal to not having job opportunities. I would like for this esteemed group of people to do, have done some empirical data of what was the mental state of slave owners. I've never heard of how they felt about that. Where is our reparation? Not jails. African Americans are the only race of people who were brought here in chains and shackles. We do not know our native land, the name of it. We do not know our family name, and we do not know our language. Most of us have last names that are our slave owners' names. Where is our reparation? Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is...
We, So we're going to let you testify, and then there was somebody that was missing that didn't come, so we're going to fill in that spot with one more. So you and one more, and then sure. We'll go to the amendment.
Sure thing.
Go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you. My name is Darnella Wade. I've lived in Minnesota most of my adult life. I'm 43 years old. I have four children. In 1991, I had my first son. In 1993, his father was shot and killed in Minnesota. In 2001, Minnesota came up with a clever way to push welfare reform and cutting kids off 5 years total, forgetting the fact some of these children don't even have fathers, so you should have made an exclusion or exception for those children. 25 years ago, you still haven't turned around for the children. Now, 2014, my third son shot in St. Paul, Minnesota. I've been off welfare because of your clever way of taking in the welfare reform, Clinton reform, unthought out, but you guys didn't think about it either. You just pushed it without thinking about the collateral damage. Now, here it is, 16 years off of welfare, four kids, still in Minnesota. I can't relocate because you know it's a nationwide law. This problem of poverty is going to be everywhere I go. In these 16 years, $697 was all me and four children would have got. However, we didn't receive it. For 1 year, it's $8,364. In 16 years, it's $133,000, $824,000. However the hell you want to put the comma, it never made it to us. Now my son is shot. I have a father deceased. We're off of welfare. I work for the state of Minnesota. 30 years have been passed. Your welfare grants are inadequate. I see a whole lot of numbers. $180,000 per bed per criminal. $8,000 for a family on a welfare grant in a year. Same families. You're producing criminals with your laws. You are. It is time you think about the numbers, because we can't afford to take any more of your collateral damage. It's not fair. First thing you need to do is remember the first line of defense is parenting. You do not have a right to take this preschool prison to pipeline and shove it back in our faces. We are taxpayers. We don't want to invest in this. We want to invest in our future. And Appleton Prison is not where I see myself. I don't see my kids there. And the other part is, if you don't deal with legislation and how it appropriately affects the people, we're going to deal with morgues and obituaries. You get to comfortably go home. Your lunch is free. You do not go to jail for parking tickets. You have a very, very comfortable life. It's comfortable, and it is at the expense of me. It is. I would prefer for y'all to have minimum wage jobs to save the people some money. You do not deserve to have your golden parachutes and then come here and tell us how I deserve nothing. That's not fair. It's not fair to my deceased baby father. It's not fair to my child that doesn't have a father. It's not your fault, but you have to take on responsibility of what you are implementing into our real life. And it is not right for you to go and get a private prison to put the public people in.
And could you wrap up real quick?
I'm done.
Okay.
But I also have a son who's in Bethesda. He got shot February 16th. Our medical bills are well into $20,000. If you don't think turning on the grants is the first way to detour crime, you are sadly mistaken. And if you think that we're going to let you, that means we, the people of Minnesota, are adamantly telling, asking, don't pass this law. We could do with $250 million, we could do better. We need daycares in rural America, rural Minnesota. Help us. Do not be our enemy. Because all your jobs, it's just a job. Parenting is not an option.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. State your name and go ahead. You're the last testifier, and then we'll move into the...
Okay. My name's Vanessa Taylor. I live in Minneapolis, but I'm from Hastings, Minnesota. So that's in Dakota County. I don't know if y'all know a lot about Hastings, but one of the biggest issues there is that there's a lot of drugs. My neighbors run a meth house. We've lost a lot of people my age to meth. We have a jail there. It doesn't do shit for us. It doesn't do anything. There's no jobs with that jail. We turn the drugs because we have nothing. If you're growing up in Hastings, you have nothing to do. There are no jobs for you. The education system is not set up for you. Even out there, nobody cares about you because you're rural kids. Even though it's not that far away, we're still rural enough that none of y'all care. People in Hastings, the only thing we do is we wake up to get out. Okay? I woke up for 4 years just to get away from home. The year I graduated, we lost about 6 people. Most of them from suicide. And none of you did anything to help us. We lose people from drugs. We lose people from suicide. We have no counselors. Nobody actually cares about rural Minnesota. You have this bill to act like you care, to get some votes from them. Because we're so desperate, we will take anything you offer us. My family is so desperate, they will take anything at this point. Put another prison in Hastings. It won't save anything, but you can make them think so. But I want to touch on that amendment to ban these private prisons, because that's what really needs to happen here. Listen, talking about rural Minnesota, how all y'all want to do is win the votes. Obviously, because you bust them all here. But where are the kids whose communities you're going to over-police? See, I'm 20 years old, so I'm one of the black youth that you want in those prisons, right? My friends are the black youth y'all want in those prisons. My friends are the black kids that y'all traumatized. My friend has memory loss from what the 4th Precinct did to her. I have trauma from what the 4th Precinct did to me. And instead of helping us with that, you shuttle us into prisons? Listen, if you want to put me in a prison to die, because that's what is going to happen to me, if you put me there, then you may as well bring us all here so you can look us in the eyes. If you want to sentence me to death, you better have the dignity to look me in the eyes and recognize that is what you're doing to me. Yep. We are not your cattle. You may seem to think so because that's what your ancestors brought us here as. That's what y'all wanted us to be, but that is not the reality anymore. You are tearing apart our communities, you are tearing apart our families, and you are sentencing us to death. For what? Money? Listen, I live, I breathe, I feel, I hurt, and what am I worth to? Some money, some dollars. A little more extra money for your comfortable lifestyle. That's what my life is worth to you. Because that's what you're telling me, that's what you're telling all of us, if you do not ban these private prisons, not just Appleton, all of them.
To the DE1 amendment, a roll call vote has been requested. To take the roll call.
Representative Cornish.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Considine.
Yes.
Representative Dean.
Yes.
Representative Flanagan.
Yes.
Representative Hertas.
No.
Representative Hillstrom.
Yes.
Representative Howe.
No.
Representative Lomer.
No.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Neuberger.
No.
Representative O'Neill.
No.
Representative Quam.
No.
Representative Rosenthal.
Yes.
Representative Schoen.
Yes.
Representative Ward.
Yes.
Representative Zerwas.
No.
Okay, with 7 ayes and 10 nays, the motion fails.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'd like a roll call vote on the final bill, and then I'd like to make a brief statement when you're ready for closing.
I'm ready to close. Go ahead.
All right. Members, I would encourage you to vote no on this bill. when we look back at the history of CCA in Minnesota, we found that the impact that they had on inmates was actually it increased the rate of recidivism. It increased the likelihood of rearrest. When we look at reconviction rate, they actually had a 22% higher rate of reconviction if they spent any time in the Prairie Correctional Facility. I believe that private prison confinement is profiting from incarceration, and I do not believe that that is the right thing for Minnesotans. I encourage you to vote no on the bill.
Okay, Representative Miller, we're not going to have you do a closing statement. The chair will renew his motion that 3223 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And we have a roll call vote requested?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Clerk will take the roll.
Representative Cornish?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Considine?
No.
Representative Dean?
No.
Representative Flanagan?
No.
Representative Hertas?
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom?
No.
Representative Howell?
Yes.
Representative Lomer?
Yes.
Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative Neuberger?
Yes.
Representative O'Neill?
Yes.
Representative Kwan?
See.
Representative Rosenthal?
No.
Representative Schoen?
No.
Representative Ward?
No.
Representative Zerwas?
Yes.
Okay, the vote being 10 aye and 7 nay, the bill is referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Meeting adjourned.